I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is one of my favorite shows. I enjoy its freewheeling style, its topical, irreverent humor, its smart and smart-alecky panelists, the limericks, the chance to hear celebrities answer ridiculous questions, and mix it up with the quick-witted host, Peter Sagal. The program just celebrated its 20th anniversary in November, one of the most popular shows on NPR. In fact, Peter Sagal was a panelist for a brief time before he became the host. He's also been an avid runner, a committed marathoner for many years, and writes in his new book, The Incomplete Book of Running, about how it helped him through a painful divorce. I also recently listened to an interview he did for the podcast The Hilarious World of Depression about his own lifelong struggle with depression. We will talk about all of this, including running and the show and Peter Sagal's life. And he sits across from me here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's very exciting to be here.
Exciting to have you. And let me just make sure our listeners can join the conversation. There are many ways to do this. You can call us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Did you run today?
I did. I got up and I ran a good 6 miles, including, because it's Philadelphia, running up the steps of the Art Museum and
you.
Jumping up and down like a moron. I did that with a bunch of newish friends here in Philadelphia, including Rebecca Barber, who is a local runner who runs the Rocky 50K. Do you know about this?
I do not.
This is sort of a loosely organized long distance run in which every December, Rebecca organizes a bunch of people who come out and they recreate, if you can follow along here, Rocky's training montage run from Rocky II. A local author, journalist, whose name I cannot remember, and I'm sorry for this, retraced his steps, watched that montage through the neighborhoods of Philadelphia. Now, if you know Philadelphia and you watch the montage, you're like, this is ridiculous because each shot takes him like 10 miles from the last shot, so it's impossible. But he said, so if you actually ran it in the order in which Rocky appears, he'd run about 50 kilometers around the city. Well, Rebecca, being the kind of person she is, organized this race, and they do this every year. They run around, preferably wearing the classic Rocky gray sweats.
Do you run because you have to?
At this point, yes, I do. If I did not run on a regular basis, I would slowly go insane, or more insane, perhaps, than I already am. So it's sort of maintenance at this point.
In fact, you write in your book that you're easier to live with because you run or after you run.
And I'm not easy to live with to begin with. So believe
true?
Me. Oh, yes. I could introduce you to some people who could testify to that. The fact that I get up and I'm a much happier person for having gotten up and gone running of a day. And that's actually something I've become something of an evangelist about, a zealot even. I honestly believe that all the things that are driving everyone crazy, all the people listening to this, you, me, all of them, most of them, can be somewhat alleviated by getting outside and running around like a maniac. I think when you come back, we'll all feel a little better.
Well, it's interesting. 40 years ago or so, I trained for a 5-mile run.
Hey.
Hated every minute of
it. Did you?
Never ever done it.
What did you
again.
Hate about it? Why was it so bad?
I did not. Every step was boring.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt that euphoria that you're supposed to feel. I know that's probably an elusive experience,
yes.
But nonetheless, I never had that moment of just, wow, here it's me and my body and we're moving.
And how long were you at it? I.e., you trained up for this 5-mile run, but how long did you?
3 or 4 months.
Right. Well, okay. It is.
Am I forgiven?
You are. Everybody's forgiven. I'm a very forgiving person at my age. And sometimes it doesn't work for people, and some people just don't like it. I think that there are more people who will benefit from it than they themselves think. For some people, it doesn't work out.
Right.
Generally speaking, what most people find, I find, is that it's great just to get outside.
And I agree with that.
And one of the reasons I'm such an advocate for running is, unlike a lot of other things which people might suggest to you or other people might be trying to sell you, such as, gym classes, gym membership, CrossFit, and they're all great. It's good to get exercise. Whatever you choose is better than nothing. But the great thing about running is there is no entry fee, metaphorical or real. Anybody listening right now could go outside and run a mile in whatever shoes and clothes you're wearing. You don't have to buy anything. You don't need any classes. We were, to borrow a phrase, born to run, quite literally.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it seems because it's so simple, people think it is boring, that they need some sort of mental challenge. But I've become an advocate for simplicity, that there's something very powerful about shedding everything, including instructions, including special equipment, including schedules, and just going out and moving. And I think that if you put yourself into that mindset of just the simplicity of it, all of a sudden you start to gain benefits.
I did appreciate and understand the part of the book where you describe when you go to a city, you're here,
yes.
you're a Chicago person, you're in Philadelphia, what you can see, what you can hear, what you can learn as
yes.
you run through a city, perhaps a city you've never been in before.
Yeah, and there's a it's funny, I've been doing a project with my friend Kyle Cassidy about people's favorite books as a child, and mine was The Phantom Tollbooth by Norton Juster.
Okay.
And there's that book is filled with parables and stories, and one of them is about a city that has slowly disappeared. And the hero of the book, Milo, says, why has the city disappeared? And he said, well, because everybody walked around so caught up in their own thing, staring at the ground, that they just stopped looking, and without anyone to see it, the city has vanished. And this was, of course, before smartphones. Most of us now, I've done this, walk into objects because I'm so busy staring at my phone. And I think this is, again, bad. One of the things I advocate for is when you go for a run, leave your phone behind. And people are like, oh, God, I can't do that. What if I get a text? Or it's so boring, I need to listen to a podcast. And my theory is that you can survive 30 minutes just in your own head looking around. Just go outside and look around and see what happens. Somebody said to me as I advocated for this somewhere that, I can't do that because my thoughts and myself, we don't get along.
So therefore, Boy, do I know that feeling.
Yeah, right. And so this person, like a lot of people, decides to drown them out by putting in headphones or staring at whatever. And I'm like, if there was a person who you had to live with, as you have to live with your own brain, who you didn't get along with, the solution would probably not be to continue to try to ignore that person, you probably try to spend time with them and try to get along better. And I think that's an important thing to do with your own thoughts. I think we need to be more at home with our own heads and our own thoughts and our own subconscious and our own consciousness more than we are. And going outside and running is a good way to do it.
Well, that's an interesting thing you say because you describe being a chubby or pudgy teenager.
Yes.
Growing up in New Jersey, starting to run.
Mm-hmm.
I would say run to the point of almost anorexia.
Yeah, that was not so good.
But this struggle, I mean, I think all teenagers struggle with their body, their self-image,
yeah.
All the things that are going on with them. But this seemed to be something that you just so latched on to.
Yeah, well, I've had two running booms in my life, both of which I write about in the book. The first happened when I was an adolescent growing up in Berkeley Heights, New Jersey, in North Jersey, if people know or care about that.
Mm-hmm.
And to make it a brief story, I was, as a lot of teenagers I think are, an unhappy and socially awkward kid. I was nerdy back before being a nerd was cool. Oh, you nerds today. You don't know how hard we had it when I was a youth. Anyway, so I decided that I had a lot of problems, and one of which was that I was kind of pudgy, and I decided that I should do something at least about that. I couldn't do anything about my other problems, and so I started running and lost a lot of weight and somewhat became obsessive about it and experienced something that I think was very much akin to anorexia.
Yeah.
And as I write in the book, girls, of course, are known. This is something associated with adolescent girls. I think that it happens with adolescent boys, but usually adolescent boys, like myself, mask it in terms of extreme athletics, right? So, well, a girl might just start starving herself, causing alarm to those who love her. A boy might say, well, I'm just going to cut weight for, say, wrestling. Or in my case, I'm going to start running 7-8 miles a day, and I'm going to diet because I want to improve my running.
1,000 calories a day, we should say.
And people are like, well, that's good for you because you're trying to improve your athletic performance. And so the boys don't get noticed, even though that I think that there's the same kind of self-destructive, you know, you're trying to erase yourself is what's going on. And I think that happened to me for a period of time. It's funny, the book's come out, and I've heard from at least one person I was close to in high school, and she was like, I had no idea that you were going through this. Because how does it present? Mm-hmm. It presents as getting healthy.
Well, and you also write about, I mean, it obviously makes sense, is boys or even men and body shaming.
Yeah.
I mean, women know this, live this so
yeah,
well, but that men have their own version of that.
It's funny. I guess one of the things that I've done is I've talked openly about some things that certainly other men feel that it's hard to talk about, but they've been responsive. And one of the things I talk about is male body image problems. And I should say, as I always say, that they are as nothing compared to what women have been subjected to for centuries in terms of having to, match some unreasonable ideal of what a physique should be. But it's something that men are dealing with now too, because, you know, if you go and you see the latest superhero movie, every man who appears has a six-pack abs and enormous arms.
Totally.
And
that's why we're there.
You know, it's gotten to the point where the nerdy best friend is basically a superhuman. And those of us normal human beings, we go home and we look at ourselves in the mirror and we're like, oh my gosh, this is not going well for us. And so I think it's something that men deal with but almost never discuss.
But do you feel – I mean, you're in shape. You run.
Yeah.
You're not a pudgy kid anymore.
Not a pudgy kid anymore.
When you look in the mirror, do you say, you know, not bad for a guy X, Y, Z,
age? Yeah, I think, you know, one of the stories that that I think we all go through, maybe this is like everybody's story, is a story of like not transforming yourself into something – well, let me back up a little bit. One of the things that I am against is the constant propaganda – that we are given by, you know, athletic companies, trainers, Nike, all the companies that are selling us the chance, spoken or unspoken, to transform yourself into something else, right?
Right.
To become the person on the cover of Shape or Runner's World or Men's Fitness, to become something else. And that's never going to happen. You and I and 99.9% of the people listening to us are never going to be that person. We don't have the genetic gifts or the youth or the perverse hairlessness. What we can do, though, is to become the best version of ourselves that's practical, that's possible given everything else we're dealing with. And that, I think, is a much healthier goal. And I've come over the course of my life to sort of say, yeah, you know, I come from pudgy Jewish stock. You know, bald, short, and round. And I ain't never going to be able to do nothing about that unless, you know, genetic technology gets a lot better than it currently is. And so given that, I'm doing pretty well.
So when you look in the mirror, you say, not bad, Peter's saying,
I don't look like
a pudgy Jewish guy.
Exactly. I don't look like my father yet. It's coming, but I've put off the, you know, like not today, I believe is what Aragorn said.
A tweet from Rich. We're almost having a break here. A question for Peter. Are you humorous while running? Does it help to dream up funny stories?
Sometimes, although a lot of people ask me about this. And, you know, I have this radio show that you might have heard of where I am required to be funny. And I enjoy being funny. And hopefully you agree that I am being funny because people listen to it. But there's more to me than that. And one of the great truisms of life is anybody who's known for being funny will want to be taken seriously.
Right.
And anybody who's known for being serious will want to be funny. And so a lot of the things I think of when I'm running are not funny at all. And in fact, but that helps me be funny. If I go for a run and, you know, as I sometimes do, give long speeches condemning my enemies and get that out of my system, I can come back and write fart jokes.
Well, good for you. Peter Sengel, our guest on Radio Times today. He is the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR. You can hear this on WHYY as well. And he's got a new book called The Incomplete Book of Running. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Peter Sengel about running, something that he writes about in his book, The Incomplete Book of Running. He also writes a bit about his life, and we will be talking about Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me as well. You write in your book that you are a, quote, bipedal Eeyore. Eeyore, who's asked, I think, by Winnie the Pooh, how are you? And he says, not very how. But you also, and
that's
I mentioned
a good Eeyore impression.
Thank you. Oh, that was my childhood. But you, I mentioned this podcast. You were the first guest, I believe, on this podcast called The Hilarious World of Depression, where you really do reveal a lot about you that I did not know or even imagine the kind of really lifelong struggle that you've had with depression.
Yeah, it was interesting. John Moe, who's the host and creator of that show, listeners might know him from his prior show, Wits, that may have been on HYY. I don't know.
For a bit.
And John is a guy who, due to his career, his prior show was spending a lot of time with comedians. And if you spend a lot of time with comedians, you know that a lot of comedians are out there, and this is not a coincidence, tend to deal with a kind of mental struggles, often depression and social anxiety. That's how we end up becoming comedians. And I heard that John was doing this, and I kind of Well, I didn't kind of. I volunteered. I said, I want to be on your show.
Yeah.
And I did that for a couple of reasons. The first reason was quite simply I wanted to pass on, pay it forward, as it will, a certain gift. I had read an interview with Rachel Maddow, who I admire tremendously. She's incredibly smart and incredibly talented and incredibly productive and the top of her game, and we all know these things. And Rachel Maddow did an interview where she talked about struggling with depression and how she feels like she's useless and she can't do anything and everything she's done is pointless and stupid. And I was amazed because it never occurred to me that someone so obviously accomplished, confident, successful could feel those things. And like me, and I felt some comfort. And so I said to myself, maybe if I do the same thing, there are other people in the world who might take the same benefit. And I've so far as I can tell, it's turned out to be true. People come up to me and it's kind of, you know, people thank me for doing it. They often, what they'll do is they come up and they say, oh, I love Wait, Don't Tell Me. And then they kind of lean in and they say, you know, and I also really appreciate the interview you did. And it's always very strange to being saying, oh, thank you very so much for your work. And also thank you for talking about your mental illness. Well, you're welcome, I guess.
Now, does it feel like a mental illness?
It's,
I mean,
you know,
that's probably the technical medical term.
Yeah, it's a little strange. I mean, I did this voluntarily. No one forced me to do it. And yet at the same time, it's, I guess this is why people don't do it. It's a little weird to have people come up who you don't know. I mean, these are obviously people who've heard it but are not friends of mine and say, thank you for sharing intimate details of your life, which I now know about you. And you're like, oh, yeah, nonetheless. I'm glad I did it. The other reason I did it was because I was writing this book, and when I started to write the book or got the deal to write the book or to sign the contract, it was just going to be a breezy book about running, which would, by the way, centered about my running of the 2011 Philadelphia Marathon, which was a very successful marathon for me. Thank
you,
Philly.
Your best number, right?
My best time. And then everything changed, and I went through a lot of difficulties, and I needed to find out how to write about those difficulties in a way that was not off-putting, depressing, cruel to the people who I had to write about. And doing that podcast was sort of a first attempt at it. And I learned a little bit about how to do that.
How to talk about the words to use.
Yeah, because it's tough to write about your problems, especially if your problems relate to, you know, personal crises. Because frankly, there's definitely for all of us, I want to talk to you about my divorce. And everybody goes, oh, whoa, yeah, you know, I've got to go and spend some time doing my taxes, and they flee the room. And to learn how to talk about it in a way that does justice to your experience and yet at the same time provides something for the person you're speaking to pay attention to that isn't painful or embarrassing is difficult. And that's a line I had to learn to walk, and it was tricky.
Well, and I appreciate it is tricky because you are talking about what clearly was a painful, difficult,
yes,
sounds like angry divorce.
It was not a happy time.
Not a happy time. Three children involved, which obviously complicates it as well. And I think for a lot of people, they think, oh, comedy's over here, you know, tragedy's over there, and never the two shall meet.
By the way, I just want to let everybody know this is not a book about a divorce. It's a book about which a divorce, but nobody wants to hear about that. It's a book in which it comes up and it provides the context for a lot of other things I went through. And it turns out that one of the things that I got out of running that I didn't know until I needed it was an ability to endure difficult things, as I ended up calling it in a phrase I made up while I was writing the paragraph. The practice of persistence turned out to be somewhat valuable training.
And you've run how many marathons?
14 to date.
Whoa.
Yeah.
You also describe you were at the 2013 – you ran in the 2013 Boston Marathon. In fact, you were with a runner who was essentially blind
nearly blind. He has something called cortical blindness, which is a sort of a different kind of blindness but nonetheless needed a guide. And I had ended up there because of my domestic situation. I needed to get out of the house. It was not comfortable there, and I got this invitation to go run the Boston Marathon as a guide for a blind runner, something I'd never done before, and ended up doing it. And we ended up, just to give away the end of this particular story, crossing the line just a few minutes before the bombs went off in Boston. So that was an interesting day.
Yeah. An understatement there, just to underscore that. You got across the finish line at 4:09, and the bombs went off at 4:04,
and the bombs went off at 4:09.
So five minutes.
We had not moved very far away because my friend William, who had just run the race, was kind of collapsing. It was a tough race for him. So we were standing right there when the bombs went off, and it was pretty crazy. I should say, I wasn't hurt in any way. I wasn't even really that traumatized because we were not able to see the blood and the destruction that had happened on the other side of the finish line. So I just want to make it clear. I feel very sensitive about like walking around pretending to be a survivor of that incident. I am not that.
But you heard the explosion, obviously.
Oh, yeah. And it was weird and traumatic. I ended up actually going on NPR News. It was my one and only gig as an NPR News correspondent. I was very proud. I was talking to Robert Siegel as if I was a serious person. It was fun. Mm.
Let's talk about Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Oh, yes, that.
the show that you host. And you started as a panelist.
I did.
How did you end up being first a panelist before the host?
Basically, I got lucky. One day in 1997, my phone rang. It was a guy I knew, a theater director who actually runs the Old Globe Theater in San Diego now. And he said, Peter, I got these friends who are putting together a show for NPR, and they're looking for funny people to read a lot of newspapers. And I thought of you. Would you be interested? Well, of course I'd be interested. I was an NPR addict. I was listening to, you know, Fresh Air and every other show, you know, religiously every day. And so, yes, of course I'd love to be on NPR. And so I auditioned via phone for this new show on NPR. I was cast as a panelist. The first show that was broadcast in January 1998, the first week of January, was the panel was myself, Roxanne Roberts, and Roy Blunt Jr.
Oh, wow. Nice lineup.
It was. And the show went on, and I got a call about a month later. I should say, I don't know if it was on HYY. I think it was in those early days. It was not very good.
Because?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. NPR, as you may or may not know, is not known for its humor. It's not a lane that they often drive down. Even though the executive producer of the show, Doug Berman, was the producer of Car Talk, the only successful comedy show on NPR. And they decided that they sort of had to reboot it from scratch. They decided one of the problems was the person who was hosting. So they called and asked me if I would like to be the host. And to this day, I'm not quite sure why they did that, except out of a sense of desperation. They needed to do something quick. And apparently they found my approach to be somewhat hosty. So they asked me to do it on a trial basis. So I did it, and it went well, and I've been doing it for 20 years.
And listening back to those early tapes, do you recognize the Peter Sagal that we hear today?
No. I mean, I've only had one job in radio. It was kind of funny because NPR has its own rules for employment, so I had to apply for the job, and they said, list all relevant experience. And I was like, well, I've been doing the job I've been applying for a couple of months. That's about it. No, I had to learn how to be on the radio, and it turned out to be an interesting challenge because I had been a playwright. And being a playwright, there are a number of things you try to do, among other things, be different every time, challenge the audience, maybe even annoy the audience, be clever, be inventive, sometimes even disorient the audience with what you're trying to do because it's new. I mean, one of the things you never want to do as a theater artist is repeat yourself. And what I learned about radio is that it's very different, that among other things, one of the things that people want from radio is they want a certain, and I say this with all you know, due respect, they want a certain sameness. They want to know that when they tune in to hear this show, that they're going to hear you, and there's going to be a certain kind of conversation. It would be if you all of a sudden started playing freeform jazz on your ukulele, they'd be upset because that's not why they tuned in.
Right.
You want to be consistent with what you're offering your audience. And here's the most important thing. The radio audience doesn't want you to be clever. They don't want you to be challenging. Those things are nice. They want you to be somebody who they would like to spend some time with.
They want to like you.
They want to like you. They need to like you because otherwise, why in the world would you spend time with somebody? And one of the things I discovered coming especially from the theater to radio is how intimate radio is. And I got – this experience was disorienting at first. People would come up to me who I did not know and talk to me as if they knew me.
Right.
And I thought that was weird. But then I realized, well, these people are listening to me in the privacy of their homes or their cars or their bathrooms.
It's you and them.
It's
right?
You and them. It's just you and them. And they invite you. People are inviting us right now into their most private spaces. And it feels like, and I started to think of it as a fan of radio myself, as if a very intimate interaction with people. You're right there with them. And so I started to learn how to be somebody that was worthy of that invitation, if you will. And that's been sort of an education.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Peter Sagal, a very familiar voice to NPR listeners, to listeners here at WHYY, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, that just celebrated its 20th anniversary. He's also a runner, a marathoner, and the author of a new book called The Incomplete Book of Running. And again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. There was a, I think it was a New York Times article celebrating the 20th anniversary of Wait, Wait, and there were a couple of your favorite guests, Dick Van Dyke being yes. one of them. So we just want to play a very short clip of the quiz. He's playing the quiz on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Let's give that a listen. There we go.
When a young man, Dick Nixon, fell in love with one Pat Ryan, who was acting in a play with her, he courted her fiercely, including doing what? A, composing a song in her honor titled Pat Pat, You Make My Heart Go Pitter Pat. B, driving her to and from dates with other men. Or C, making what some say might be history's first ever mixtape.
I think he wrote a song.
You think he's going to go with that?
Yeah.
Sadly, no, he did not write a song. He drove her to and from dates with other men and wait around, like in a bookstore or a movie theater, until she was done and drive her home.
You're trying to say he was a pimp?
I'm sorry, but in the universe in which I live, you, Dick Van Dyke, do not know that word. I'm having some trouble.
That goes back to 2010 on yeah. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Dick Van Dyke, one of your faves
yes,
when it comes to celebrity guests.
People ask me, you know, who's your favorite celebrity guest? And I've interviewed a lot of people, and they've pretty much all been great, with a couple of exceptions, which I can get into. But my favorites have consistently been the people I really admired as a kid. And fortunately, I got to do this soon enough that I was able to talk to a lot of them. Dick Van Dyke is one of them. Yeah. Leonard Nimoy, Carrie Fisher. Sadly, those two are no longer with us. And that's an extraordinary privilege to be able to talk to these people and find out that they are as wonderful as you hoped they were when you were a younger person admiring them. And it's wonderfully gratifying. And I got to tell you, what's even more gratifying is talking to, say, Carol Burnett or William Shatner, which I finally got to do just a couple of weeks ago, and finding out from them that they like what you do. And, you know, it's
a nice thing.
It's a very nice thing. It's better than a sharp poke in the eye with a sharp stick.
Here's a tweet. Can you ask Peter how much he preps his celebrity guests like William Shatner before they go on the air?
Interestingly enough, I did not prep William Shatner at all because we were told by William Shatner's people that he does not do pre-interviews. So there you are. Weirdly, the only other person who did that was Adam West, who played Batman, who I also got to talk to, which was cool. So I guess there's something about 60s TV stars. They don't do pre-interviews. But one of the things I do always like to talk to our guests prior to the show, I do this for a couple of reasons. The first reason is sometimes they don't know who we are, and they think they're going to be on like Fresh Air with Terry Gross. So they're expecting trenchant, serious questions about their innermost artistic and emotional processes, and we're like, no, we're going to ask you multiple choice dumb questions. Don't you should be ready for that. And the second reason is I always find it's better to get to know them a little bit, just chat with them. Sometimes if they're people I really admire, I get to gush about them in a way that my producers don't let me do when we're actually
get
on
it
the
out
air.
Of your system.
Get out of my
way.
System. Oh, I think you're so great.
But, something I said to Peter Sagal this morning, but nonetheless.
And sometimes something weird comes up. Like, for example, we were backstage about to go out and do a show in front of 10,000 people at Millennium Park. And I was chatting with Jeff Tweedy backstage. And I don't like talking about anything that I think we're going to talk about on stage because it's hard for people to repeat that experience if they're not professional entertainers, to talk about something again if they've already told you it. They feel like they're boring you. But so I was talking about something that I didn't think that we would talk about on stage. And he said I asked him about the fact that I had recently learned that he was converted to Judaism. And he said, yeah. And we started talking about the fact that as a convert to Judaism, he had to be ritually circumcised. And I said, would you like to talk about that on stage? And so he said yes, and we did. And it was pretty great. So sometimes you find out stuff that you can use.
That's the joy of radio. I know Gene Simmons. No
oh,
surprise
yes,
here.
Yes,
your least favorite.
My least favorite.
And we certainly know from this, the Fresh Air interview.
Oh, yes. This is a great story for fans of Terry. Terry's interview with Gene Simmons is legendary. Because
he was so obnoxious.
He was so obnoxious. Now, on that same book tour, he appeared on Wait, Wait and was just as obnoxious with us, except unlike Terry, we did not have the guts to broadcast it. So we cut out all the insanely misogynistic, hateful, rude, horrible things that Gene Simmons said to us and my colleagues and broadcast the shortest interview we've ever done. Hello, Gene Simmons. Well, here's some questions. Goodbye, Gene Simmons. But here's the great part. Here's the beauty part. When he was on the air with Terry, he was going on about how boring NPR was. Yeah. And Terry challenged him, that you've never listened to NPR, have you? And he hadn't. So he paused for a sec and he said, I've been on it. And he described being on an NPR show, which he couldn't remember the name of, but he mocked the host of the show for being boring and stiff. And that was me. He actually
congratulations,
did. Congratulations,
Peter Sagal.
Gene Simmons did a mocking imitation of me to Terry Gross. And that, I hope, will lead my obituary.
Let me read a Facebook comment from Rupert, who says, this is something you said earlier, I'd actually love to hear Marty playing free jazz on ukulele.
I think that would be wonderful.
I don't think so. I used to play the recorder.
Did you really? Does anybody actually seriously play the recorder if they're not in the fourth grade or band music class?
Sadly, I did for a while and had to hang up my recorder.
You should do your own theme song. You should exactly. This is Radio Times, and then play a little toodle-a-doo and then start the show.
Let me rather read a tweet from Andrew. I love Wait, Wait, but I wanted to ask Peter if he feels constant anti-Trump jokes don't offer an opportunity for Republicans to ask why public money should fund a clearly partisan show. Does he ever worry that Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me might threaten PBS NPR?
I'll take the last part of the question is no, I'm not worried about that, and I can tell you why. In regard to Trump, you have to understand something. We make fun of Trump pretty much every week. It is not partisan. I.e., we are not making fun of Donald Trump because he's a Republican or he's a conservative. First of all, I don't think he's really a conservative, and he only was a Republican starting about 3 years ago. We make fun of Donald Trump because he is a ridiculous figure. You will never hear us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me making fun of Republicans because they're Republicans. You will never hear us making jokes about marginal tax rates. One of the things that's happened that I deplore is the fact that everything has become partisan. Back when Sarah Palin was big in the news, I used to say that if thinking Sarah Palin is an idiot makes you a liberal, then probably some mornings in the frustrating days, her husband was a liberal, you know? I mean, that's just how life is. So, no, I defy the label. We're not partisan. We are humorists and satirists, and we make fun of the people who deserve satire, and Donald Trump does.
And that's Peter Sagal, our guest on Radio Times. We'll be back after this very short break. Do stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Peter Sagal, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, heard on NPR and certainly heard here at WHYY. You can join our conversation 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play an episode from The Simpsons. This is 2014 and there are some familiar voices here.
It's so much fun to finally have a friend who likes the NPR show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me as much as I do.
So, Carl Castle, how did the House Minority Whip do on our news quiz?
Well, Peter, he got 2 out of 3 right. So, he wins me recording his outgoing message.
Oh, that's okay. Really, no, no, no. Please don't.
It's not optional.
I mean, what a wonderful thing to be featured on
thing.
The Simpsons.
One of the best things about my life is that Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has become the, now that Car Talk is off the air, the go-to place for people who want to make fun of NPR, right? They make jokes about us. And I love standing in. Again, you know, we sort of take Garrison's place as well as like everything that's terrible about NPR. People use us as to represent it. We're the metonymy. I also am so glad you played that because that was one of the things I loved about that was that they gave the punchline to Carl, which I'm so happy they did. I should also say that as wonderful as that was, I would say even more wonderful for me personally was I got to be Diane's ringtone on BoJack Horseman, which was a huge honor. And I am so grateful to Raphael Wachs, whatever his last name is, for putting me in that show because that truly is better than a Peabody Award to become Diane's ringtone on BoJack Horseman.
Do you miss Carl Castle?
Very much so. Without any aspersions on Bill Curtis, who's an amazing and wonderful broadcaster and friend and partner. But Carl was, and in a weird way still is, the heart of the show. The show was really built around him. He was if you go back to the history of the show, there are very few elements that are the same from the very first day. And Carl was one of them. And once we started redoing the show, once I became the host and thinking, well, what can we do with this template we've been given? How can we change it? How can we make it better? A decision we made early on was to center on Carl, to use Carl and people's affection for him and his astonishing willingness to do anything to get a laugh. And so it was great. And one of the things, I mean, now that he's gone, one of the things I'm very happy about is that he started the show when he was in his mid-60s. He had had a long career as an NPR news guy. And we were able to give him this amazing and wonderful second act in which, among other things, he got to be funny, which we all know serious people want to be. And also he got to spend a decade going around the country and meeting listeners, people like who are listening to us right now, all of whom expressed extraordinary affection for him, which he just loved. And whenever I felt sorry for myself or like, oh, I wish I was this or oh, this is terrible, I would just look at Carl enjoying himself and say, no, be like that guy. Understand how fortunate you are and how lucky you are and enjoy every minute of it.
That's really nice. An email from Margaret is a big fan of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me podcast. I've also listened to the additional podcast of Wait, Wait, Naked and Ashamed. In one of the segments, Peter Sagal's coworkers describe that Peter is a very serious person, which leads them to delight in pranking him. How does Peter feel about how much his coworkers enjoy making fun of him?
Yeah, there's something about me. I don't know exactly what it is that makes people think, I'm going to short sheet that guy's bed. Or, to take a real example, I'm going to remove the door from the bathroom and put it in the front of Peter's cubicle. Or put an air horn under his seat. And this has and I know that they mean it as a – I mean, it's one of those weird things. It's like – they mean it as affection. I get annoyed by it, but they enjoy my annoyance so much that they do it again.
Are you truly annoyed, though?
I am slightly annoyed. I'm not a pranker. I don't like pranking people because I'm afraid of making them feel bad. There's that terrible moment when you do a prank to somebody, especially if it's a prank that involves pretending that something terrible has happened, that I can't abide doing that to people. And frankly, they've never been – their pranks on me have never been like cruel, but they've just been – let's just say that I know that there's a vicious cycle of going on. If my getting annoyed by it says, oh, let's do that again.
But isn't there humor and whatever its opposite is, cruelty even? I mean,
yeah.
Isn't there kind of a synergy there?
It's weird. It's something we think about a lot because you can when you're making jokes, you're making fun of something or someone. And you start down that road and all of a sudden, if you're not careful, you're mean. And that is something that we care about a lot. And wait. It's not, another thing I had to learn about, because you want to walk up to the line of cruelty, but never cross it. And one of the things I had an early lesson, we're getting away from pranks, but back when I forget his name, but the Crocodile Hunter, that guy who was on TV, and he died. And for some reason, I thought it was very funny the way he died. And I did some jokes about it. And I thought they were very funny jokes. And people were very upset. It's the most upset they've ever gotten with me.
What was the joke?
Oh, the joke was I made a joke about his funeral and all the animals were standing around. And they were like, you know, he used to grab me by the tail. I don't really like that when he did it, frankly. It's kind of annoying. And I still thought that was funny. But people wrote in. And what they let me know was the jokes may or may not have been funny objectively, but we just didn't want to laugh about that. We're really sad about that. And people told me that that was a show that they watched with their kids, and their kids were very upset that he had died. This is a show that they had come to admire this guy, that they knew about his family. And I realized that you have to be careful about what you're going to make fun of, that there are things that people want to laugh about, there are things that people want to be able to take less seriously, and then there are things that they don't. And you need to respect that. That if you're somebody who insists that people think something is funny even if they don't want to, you're not going to last long in doing this.
An email from Peter. I'm not sure if he's pulling our leg or not, but he said, I stopped listening to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me because the show goes too far over the top with its ridicule of Philadelphia and its sports fans.
Oh, yes, we do that.
Doesn't everybody?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry. Like, I didn't throw those batteries. And first of all, every Philadelphia sports fan that I know personally kind of revels in this, right? I mean, I've heard stories about the old stadium, and I've heard stories about
snowballs
at Santa and the jail in the basement and Veterans Stadium, and I've heard stories about the old basketball arena. And so, come on, guys, you kind of enjoy it. And
I think we can take it.
I think you can
take
it. A number of years ago, we're all Red Sox fans, my family, so we came down to Philadelphia for a series. It must have been around 2007, 2008. And we went and we saw three games as fans of the opposing team at your baseball stadium. And the Phillies fans we met were all kind of hilarious. So, well, probably won't kill you. So I think they're all right with it.
I do, too. Let me play one more clip. This is from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, going back to 2005. And this is then-Senator Barack Obama.
I'm just wondering what the Senate is like.
There is a sense of awe and grandeur when you walk into the Senate building. You know, each of us have these little desks that you can't write anything on because they're too tight. They're like the desks you had in elementary school. Parents, when you go to, parent-teacher day and you're sitting there squatting, that's how it feels. But when you pull the drawers open, there are the names carved inside of all the previous occupants of the desk. And so in mine, you know, you'll see names like Lodge and Taft, but you'll also see names like Bobby Kennedy and Paul Wellstone, and it really gives you a sense of sort of the sweep of history that you're a part of now.
Are they supposed to do that? Or they...
You know, I suspect the first couple of guys weren't.
Yeah.
But now it's okay.
I don't think people realize the far reach of graffiti.
Are there little...
I was thinking about taking a spray can.
You know. Well, that's how we do it in Chicago.
As the only African-American in the United States Senate.
2005.
A couple of things about that. First of all, that was 2005. It was his birthday in August. He had just been elected Senate. He recently became this national phenomenon. He was there in person, and the audience went nuts for him. But here's the crazy thing about Barack Obama. So he's starting to talk about that whole thing with the desk. And I'm listening to him, and I'm thinking, you're the first black member of the Senate. There's a graffiti joke. Do I dare make that joke? And I'm thinking about it, and he made it. And that says a couple of things. First of all, one of the frustrating things about dealing with Obama is often the best jokes about him, he makes himself before you can get to him, which made it very hard for us to make fun of him. And he was smart enough to sort of think of that joke and realize he could tell that joke. And he did. And it was – I've never in my life seen somebody look around a room, our live audience, and understand exactly what that room needed and deliver it perfectly. And he left that stage and went off with – I think he was going home to celebrate his birthday.
2005, so Senator.
And as soon as he was off stage, I made sure he was gone, and I looked at the audience and I said, that guy's going to be president. So it's my fault. He's a remarkably charming guy and also, like I said, hard to make fun of because he beat you to it, which is frustrating.
How do you and whoever, the writers and others on the show, how do you then – you have a show next week.
We do.
There's like news just like pouring
there
out of the TV as we're sitting
it's
here talking.
It's been so blessed not have to care about it for the last 2 weeks, I have to say.
But nonetheless, you got to come up with stuff.
We are coming back at it.
So is it a matter of saying, oh, there's a shutdown. There's Trump going off on 90 Minutes
there's
with
a lot
cabinet.
Of things. With apologies to the person who wrote in earlier who thinks that we're all anti-Trump all the time, we're not really. We're anti-Trump or at least making fun of Trump for only the first couple of minutes of the show because we know that it's exhausting. We know that part of the pleasure we provide to our audience is saying the things about the president that maybe they'd like us to say but also then talking about other things. Mm-hmm. And so we do that. But what that means is that we really have to pick our shot, that there's so many things that happen just related to him in the course of a week, let alone his larger administration, that first of all, we have to constantly change what we're going to focus on because something happens every day. And we also have to decide, okay, out of all the crazy things that happened this week, what's the one thing that we, at the end of the week, after Stephen Colbert's had his shot and Seth Meyers and Samantha Bee, what's the one thing that we can be funny and original about? And that's harder than you might think.
Yeah.
It's also hard because he does many of the same things over and over and over again, the bizarre lies and the boasting. Like this week he had a cabinet meeting where they all had to sit and praise him as the great king and the great leader. And
with a big poster in the middle of the table.
And that in and of itself is so insane that you could think that that's an amazing thing you can talk about in a comedy show. But he's done it. It's happened a dozen times before. So another problem we have is coming up with something original to say about the same old thing. It's tougher than you might think.
Let me read some more comments. A tweet from Anne. Thank you for making me laugh and think and not take myself or this world too seriously, by the way. Taking up running at the age of 58, what could possibly go wrong? And then #my knees hurt. A Facebook message from Rachel. My wife and My wife and I traveled for 7 months. We made sure to run regularly. I wanted to go a different route every day to see more of the towns we were visiting, and my wife wanted to go the same route for consistency and safety. Do you have a routine, or do you like to change it up? And then a comment from David. Just want to chime in and agree with Peter's assessment of running. It has greatly improved my life.
Yes. I think for most people it does. Marty, you are an exception. To answer the second question, whenever I go traveling, I like to go running, and I like to run different places all the time. I think there, as I say in the book, because of the way we travel for Wait, Wait, if I didn't go for a run, I may not even get out and actually know where I am, because we go from chain hotels to local restaurants to, you know, performance venues. And other, if I didn't like go for a run, I wouldn't know I was in, say, Philadelphia or Charlotte or Phoenix or wherever we might be. So I'm a great believer in urban exploring. I am very aware of the fact that that is a lot easier for me as a male than it would be for a woman, that a woman running by herself in a strange city, even in broad daylight, is dealing with a lot of real dangers that I just don't have to think about. And I'm very conscious and sort of humbled by that. But if I can think of what to do about that, I will get back to you all soon. It's a bad situation.
I have a weird segue here. This is a Jewish publication, and I just wanted to quote a couple of things that you said. You've recently remarried.
Yes.
And here's a quote here. One of the things I found is that I'm happier around Jewish people. That's who I was raised with. That's who I know how to talk to. We're obstreperous. We're crazy in our own way. And you go on from there.
Yeah.
I found that interesting.
It is interesting, and it's not something I ever thought I would say, but I experienced it because I was not and still am not, you know, a seriously Jewish person. I can't remember the last time I was in a synagogue, and I'm certainly not observant. And so, you know, didn't feel growing up like I needed to stay within the tribe. But like I said, I was married for a long time to a non-Jewish person, and I just – it was very hard for me to get along with her family. They just had a very different rhythm. Nothing wrong with them, but they just upper Midwesterners.
They
just
weren't obstreperous.
They weren't obstreperous and loud. I mean, you know, in my family growing up, argument was like our favorite sport. You know, what are you talking? My wife, Mara, who is Jewish, spent some time with my parents, who she loves them and they love her. And she told me this great story about my parents. That she was out for the day with them while I was working, and they started arguing about something. And my father said, Reva, my mother's name is Reva, Reva, why are we even arguing about this? And my mother said, because at the moment we have nothing else to argue about. And like, that's us. And like I said, so I've been so happily welcomed into my wife's family back in Chicago. And they're crazy,
yeah.
But they're crazy in a way that I find familiar, that makes sense to me. And I don't know what that means. I don't know. I guess you're just used to what you're used to, and you know, you go a long way before you find yourself back home again.
It reminds me of that wonderful scene in Annie Hall, the split screen
of
the meal,
you know,
the waspy meal,
yes,
where
exactly.
Everyone is quiet and polite, and the Jewish family, they're all cutting each other's food
exactly.
And talking over each other.
Yes, I know.
And you're more comfortable
and
with
I'm
the other
one. And I'm definitely more comfortable, yes, in that. I mean, it may be, you know, we're all tumblers. We're all jokesters. We're all talkers. It may be why there's so many of us in this business.
Well, Peter Sagal, it's been a great pleasure.
It has been an absolute delight to be on with you, Marty.
Thank you very much. Peter Sagal, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, been on NPR and here at WHYY, been on NPR for 20 years and carried here on WHYY as well. And again, he's got a new book. It's called The Incomplete Book of Running. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. In fact, we're going to keep this conversation going after this interview, and you can watch it if you become a member of our Facebook group. You just put Radio Times listeners in the space bar and you'll be in. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.